Sean McCarthy was born in Blineville outside Tralee in 1898, but later moved to Strand Street in the town. He was one of the founding members of the Cairns O'Rahilly's GA Club. As a footballer, he was midfield with his friend John George Sheehy and the Kerry senior team beaten by Galway in the All-Ireland senior semi-final replay of 1919. In 1924, he captained the Kerry junior team to All-Ireland glory when they defeated Longford in the final, trained by Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan. He later became trainer of the Kerry senior team with the distinction of winning Kerry's first four in a row, 1929 to 1932. And he had four National League successes as well. He was manager of the Kerry team that toured America in 1931. He trained the Kerry team in 1937, which drew with Cavan, and travelled to America with Kerry in 1927. And in 1947, he won senior county championship medals with Tralee Mitchells. In 1919, he won with the Mitchells and was a selector for the teams which won in 25 and 26. He represented his county in hurling when Strand Street O'Rahilly's won their first senior county championship in 1933. Sean McCarthy was the trainer that year. He was also a well-known referee and officiated at the All-Ireland senior football finals of 1934 and 1936. As an administrator in the GA, he has a record that will never be surpassed. He was appointed chairman of the Kerry County Board in 1927. He represented Kerry for 6 years in the Munster Council before becoming Munster Council Secretary in 1931. A position he held until his death in 1977, following the death of Pat McGrath Tipperary, the then Secretary of the Munster Council, on August the 21st, 1931. A special meeting was held to elect a new Secretary. There were five applicants for the position. After five series of voting, Sean McCarthy Tralee was successful, defeating F. McGrath Tipperary by 8-6. So all in all, he served on the Munster Council of the GA for 51 years. During which time he was always known for his humility and kindness, treating everybody with sincerity. It was most ironic of the day that Sean passed away the day the Munster senior football final of 1977 was played in Killarney. His extended family have proved to be terrific followers of the GA over many decades. The McCarthys of their place, they are a credit to the GA. In this programme and in following programmes, we will dedicate what we are about to reveal to the memory of Sean McCarthy. His family are very kindly taking part in the programme, and in my view, Sean McCarthy must be rated as one of the great Kerry GA personalities of all time. Sit back and enjoy Terrace Talk. Now I'm talking to Mike McCarthy. Mike is a son of Sean McCarthy. Mike, tell us how many boys were in the family?
There were four boys. I was the youngest. The eldest was Joe, John Joseph. The second eldest was Pat. And the third was Harry. And I'm the youngest.
Yeah. And how many girls?
There were six girls. The eldest was my sister Mary. We call her sister. She's the eldest. Followed by this Peggy, and then the next one is after that is Kitty, followed by Lonnie, and then Breda, and the youngest, the baby of the family, was Tina.
Now, your father was a remarkable man. Tell us something that you'd like to have him remembered for.
Well, my father, when he finished his playing career, he had an interest in administration. So what he did was he, in 1925, he joined with Dick Fitzgerald, famous Dick Fitzgerald from Killarney, and my dad and Dick were the representatives of the Kerry County Board on the Munster Council. That was a start, and my dad then was, of course, as he was involved with the Kerry County Board, he became chairman of the Kerry County Board in 1927, and the following year, he became joint secretary of the county board with then Joe Bailey. And then my father then went on to be secretary of the board in 1929 to 1931. As a representative on the Munster Council, he was a representative from 1925 to 1931, six years. And then in October 1931, my father was elected the secretary of the Munster Council. And of course, he went on to be secretary of the Munster Council until he died, the day he died, which was the 24th of July, 1977. So he was effectively, I suppose, an official in the GAA in Kerry and in Munster for a total of 52 years, which I think was an absolutely extraordinary record, which I don't think will ever be surpassed.
Michael, I agree with you fully there. Your memories, he worked from home, didn't he? He didn't, like today, they have their offices and they have computers and they have this and that and mobile phones and they have every kind of a Tom, Dick and Harry, everything. But your dad had only just a phone and he worked from home.
My father worked from a three-day place. I mean, he set up the office in three-day place and he basically worked on his own. He didn't have any secretary, but he did all the secretarial duties himself. So everything was done by my father. Everything to do with the matches. He was very busy because he had to produce the tickets for the games, for all the games. When the players and the officials with the teams would go to the matches to play, that was all during the rounds of all the championships in Munster. He used to provide the meal tickets, so they all had meal tickets and they could go into, if it was like in Killarney, they could go into the hotel, wherever my father selected hotels, and they'd get their meals. Anybody who was involved in the turnstiles, say, doing jobs there, my father would make sure they were all fed and watered, so they'd also be able to attend the hotels.
Michael, visualise his day. Would he get up at the morning? Would he sit down all day at his thing? Would he be on the move? He must be going out a lot. What are your memories of him working and the amount of time he put into it?
Well, my father's kind of routine would be he would normally in the mornings, he'd come and have his breakfast. My mum would call him down, he'd have his breakfast. And then what he would do is he would then go back upstairs and he would start off his day's work. You know, and I can remember my father, you know, during the day, he might go across from us. And there was a post box in Day Place. And I can remember my father every day, when he'd have all his letters typed and they'd be all put into envelopes and stamped, going across to the post box and putting these load of envelopes into the box. Now, sometimes he might have letters that would have to be franked, maybe taken to the post office. Now, the post office at that time was up in Edward Street. That was the main post office. And I can always remember my father. You know, he was unbelievable. I mean, he was, even to the time when he was coming up to retirement, my father could walk to the main post office, I suppose, in about 5 minutes and back again.
Well, some of them letters came to me because when I took up refereeing, he would notify me to go refereeing for the Munster Council and years before he died. So the letters he was posting, some of them came to me. Talk away to me.
Yeah. So that's, but during the winter time, my father, it was a kind of a slightly different routine. My father used to get up in the morning. He'd have his breakfast, and then what he would do is we had fireplaces, big fireplaces in Day Place. It was an old Georgian house, and you had all these big fireplaces, one in the living room, there'd be one in all the bedrooms. And so my father would he would go to each of those fireplaces and he'd clean them out himself. Nobody else would do it, because he's like his own, he just insisted on doing it himself. He would clear the fireplaces of all the ashes. And then, having done that, he would start to make the fire. And so he would go out to, with an outhouse in Day Place. He'd go to the outhouse and he'd bring in the turf and wood. And then he used to have his own method of making up a kind of to light the fire. He'd have bits of paper, newspaper, and he would knot the newspapers. And he'd put the newspapers in to start the fire off. And he would do that for every bedroom. And then at night time then, what he would do is he'd go and he'd light all the fires. And then another thing he would do is, just to make sure we were comfortable, is he'd go and he'd get boiled kettle and he'd have hot water bottles. And he'd put the hot water into the hot water bottles and he'd go up to every bedroom. And he'd make sure that he put a hot water bottle in all the beds. I mean, he'd probably move the hot water bottle because he didn't have that many hot water bottles. He'd move the hot water bottle from bed to bed just to make sure that he'd taken the cold out of it, including that, irrespective of whether there was a fire there or not, that wasn't good enough. He still had to make sure when his children went into the beds that they were they'd be comfortable.
There's no doubt we're getting a great glimpse of the man behind the man. There's no doubt he was an exemplary person. He was a great father. Would there be a lot of callers to the house? I imagine there would. What are your memories of people calling to the house?
Well, you see, because my father chose to work in his home was, that made him available like 7 days a week.
Yeah.
That was one of the problems of the job. Oh, yes, I remember regular visitors to the house. You had him from all walks of life, but of course, from the JA point of view, one of the most frequent visitors was John Joe Sheehy. John Joe and himself were great friends. Yeah. And but you had all the people from all the clubs, all the guys from the club secretaries would come and see him, seeking advice. And my father was always available. Yeah.
And Michael, he served in the Munster Council right up until the time of his death, isn't that right?
That's right, he did. He was secretary of the Munster Council right up to the day he died.
What age was he?
My father was 79 when he died.
Now I'm talking to another one of Sean's daughters. I'm talking to Piggy. Piggy, remembering your dad here again tonight now, he trained Kerry to win four All-Irelands in a row, 1929, 30, 31, 32. Now, as far as I'm concerned, it's unrecognised by most people, and most people don't realise that he did that. I mean, with all he achieved to come along, and he trained some of the greatest legendary footballers that this county has ever produced. What do you know about his training?
Well, not that much, really. Only what I read about it, Rhys, about Tim O'Donnell, that's what you call it there, and just for we were staying in the Central Hotel in Tralee. We trained under Jack at the sports field from 11 a.m. until 1 o'clock, when we broke up for a good cooked meal lunch. It was back to training again from 3 o'clock until 5, when we went back to the hotel again for another substantial meal after our dinner. We went for a 7 mile march before retiring to bed at 11 p.m. Of course, they were quite used to walking, didn't you know? They used to cycle to Matches Mark. There was very few driving, I said at times. We were very fit and great friends. We would die for each other, though there were people there who were strong opposed politically. We always broke up from training camp on Wednesday to go home for a few days. We would all meet at the train 2 o'clock for Dublin on Saturday, when there was a separate carriage supplied for the team and officials. We were very well looked after, and it paid off handsomely for Kerry football. You know, that's as much as we know, really. You know, we don't actually know what the...
Peggy, one very telling piece there in that you mentioned, he said there were some of them very opposed through their political views, which there was, but... There's no doubt, but I would imagine, and I would say here, that your father brought all those views together, because what's coming across to me was he was a remarkable man in the line of bringing people together. So he brought those political views of those great Kerry teams together and kept them together. Would that be a fair comment for me?
Yes, oh, definitely. I mean, that stands out very much in what that says there, you know, that he was the man to do. But I can imagine, knowing him, the man, that he would be able to do those things the way she like, you know.
Did you realise, growing up, all the family, that he had trained Kerry to win four All-Irelands in a row?
No, we didn't know that until Offaly beat Kerry to five
James
in a row.
Darby.
Yeah, James Darby's goal. Yeah. And Mammy said, Daddy's record's still standing. We all looked at her and said, Mammy, what are you talking about? She said, your daddy changed less four in a row.
Yeah.
We didn't know. That was the first time we ever heard of it, Rhys. The first time.
And of course, they won national leagues and everything, and railway cups that time.
That's all there, They won the national league the same times as they won the four in a row. They won the national league those four times too.
Yeah.
As far as that right, I think that's in the thing there,
That's right,
And he had record crowd, you know that, when in 1929, the crowd going toward that All-Ireland was record crowd.
Yeah.
And the gate was record, you know. What you call it? The biggest crowd ever that went to a match went to 1929.
Now, Peggy, what are your memories of your dad growing up?
Oh God, wonderful. His office, he never had a secretary, was he? He did everything himself. The place was a mess, you know, and what you call it, he'd go away, like, you know, and what you call it, I cleaned it up one time, he came back, he made a whole issue, and of course I was there waiting to be thanked, you know, and next thing he was,
what did he say?
No, what did he do? He said nothing, he'd kick everything around, he kicked everything around. Mammy was in hospital one time, had an operation, now we were kind of both now twins, and we were doing the cooking, you see. Now, Mammy did all the cooking. We watched what she was doing, but we never really had the details. So, Breda used to make...
Can you cook now?
Well, oh, yes. And Breda used to make the stuff for bread every day, wish you. Perfect. Yeah. Lovely. We want the sour to cut it. And then he'd come down every morning, you see, and he'd go out to dustbin. There was another loaf of bread inside. And of course, he'd come in and he'd kick the chair. He'd kick the chair. Two of us would be standing there looking at him, and he'd be kicking the chair around the floor, you see. We didn't know what was wrong. But he went up to Mammy and he says to Mammy, Mary and Bridget, if you don't get out of that bed and come home, they'll have me pies and things.
Were people calling to the house? Okay. And was he travelling away a lot at night to meetings and things?
He was. And what you call it, McDonough came down to interview him, I suppose, before the Munster final or something. And we were quite young at the time, like, you know, and Mick was inside. And there was a couch in two chairs, and we could sit in one chair and Daddy in the other. And you'd talk, and then we were running around like lunatics, running around, and I was always just thinking, stop, Les, now will you go out and talk to this man? I mean, really, it was ridiculous, you know, but that's the kind of person he was. He never gave out to us or anything, you know.
Peggy, in today's world now, and where you stand today, and you meet people, and you're talking to people, does his name ever crop up? Do people realise that Sean McCarthy had given his life to the Gaelic Athletic Association? Does that come across?
No, not really, no. Some people, I mean, even now you'd meet a person and you'd say, my father was secretary to Munster Council, they wouldn't even know what you call it, you know. Yeah. But there, of course, there are people that know, but very few, we should say, very, very few.
What's your fondest memory of him?
Daddy, we'd go down the evening, you know, when we had our own families, and he'd walk, like, you know, in the morning, he'd finish a trade in the evening for the post, and we'd go down with all the children. He'd be waiting below, walking up and down the side of the door. And then he'd take all the grandchildren down, even the ones in the pram. Now, you'd never see anyone rolling the pram that time, not a man anyway. And Daddy would go off down the green with all the grandchildren and what you call it. He rolling the pram in front of him, like, you know, we'd be inside eating Mammy's pie and what you call it, you know, enjoying ourselves. But then another thing is when we used to go to pictures a lot when we were younger, you know, Daddy. We'd all go to the pictures, the movies, like, you know. And he'd take us up in Harmon's. You don't realise Harmon's was there that time, just where the Binner's Hotel is now above that. And he'd take us in there and we'd all get our quarter sweets and we all had our own favourites, like, you know.
What's very clear...
We have wonderful memories, like, you know, wonderful memories.
What's very clear to me, Peggy, that despite his huge involvement and his travelling and everything, he gave equal time to his family.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yeah, we got plenty of time, didn't we? We did, yes.
Have you any memory of any particular person being a regular caller to the home?
Yes, what you call it? You were talking there now about Les about when the matches would be on, like, you know, who'd be calling. And they, if the once the final was on the All-Ireland, nobody would answer the door. No one would answer the phone. There'd be someone at the door looking for tickets. And, of course, they thought we were manufacturing them inside and we'd hand them out to them, like, you know. What you call it? I had Mammy living above with me in the last 5 years of her life, wish you. And we had a phone in the house for 50 years, like, you know. I say we were one of the few houses in Tralee that had a phone at the time. And Mammy was above with me, and I gave her the hand to the phone, and she was talking into the earpiece and the mouthpiece up to her ear. I said, God Almighty, Mother, you had a phone in the house for 50 years and you still don't know how to use it. She never answered it, I'd say.
You mentioned there about the tickets, and we were recording this 2 or 3 days before Kerry meet Dublin, the All-Ireland semi-final. Peggy, some things never change.
Oh, never change, Mish. Definitely, some things never change.
Listen, mate, it was lovely talking.
Okay, thank you.
Keep up the great work. In case anybody thinks that we're just talking about Sean McCarthy, the administrator, he was much more than an administrator because he was more than a handy footballer. Talk to us about his playing career.
Yeah. Well, in 1919... he won both hurling and football championship, which I think until today is a record.
It's
a record in Cairns O'Rahilly's particularly.
Well, he won
the two medals in the 1 year.
Yeah.
He won the hurling medal with Strand Street, as it was known, and he was known as the Chimney because he was centre back, and he was a fairly tall man, I suppose, in shoes. He was 6'1". But that wouldn't be exceptional today, but the men of the time probably were a little smaller, I don't know really. But then he played senior with Tralee Mitchells. But the story of that is very interesting, Weesh, and I'm sure you'll be very pleased to hear this. He played junior with Strand Street against The Rock and were beaten in the first round. Now, they then picked the senior team, which was the town team, Tralee Mitchells, and Dad was also picked on that. And he didn't want to accept, he thought it wouldn't be right, like in his own mind, but he did eventually accept. And they met Killarney in the semi-final. And they played the match, but there was an objection, which wasn't surprising really. But Dick Fitzgerald, who was one of Daddy's great friends, and this is a quotation from Daddy himself, He refused. The prince of footballers, Dick Fitzgerald, was too good a sportsman to win in the council chambers and insisted on a replay. And in that replay, Mitchells won again. Now, the following Sunday, they met Dingle in the county final. And Dingle were late. They weren't just late. They were 3 hours late. And they decided they'd wait for Dingle to come in, and they did wait until 7 o'clock, played the match and won it. And the score was 3-3 to 2-2. That was the score, and it was a wonderful win, and they were absolutely thrilled because obviously it was double, like, you know.
Yeah. Weren't they a great men to wait 3 hours? They wouldn't wait 3 hours today,
absolutely,
I can tell you.
Fantastic. Then on that winning, the Mitchells, Daddy and John Joshihi were centre field on that team, and they went straight into the Kerry team. And that is also another record for Daddy, because he was only a junior player going straight on the Kerry team. And it was another record. Probably broken several times after that, but at that time it was a record. And they were beaten by Galway in the All-Ireland semi-final. Now, for reasons unknown, really, they probably are known, Daddy didn't continue at senior level, but he played in the junior, as captain of the junior team in 24. And they beat Mayo 3-3 to 1-1 in the semi-final. And they went on the 25th of July, on the same year, to win against Longford. At half time, the score was 3-3. And the boys upped the game in the second half, won by 1-6 to 4 points. So that was a brilliant win altogether. Now, Daddy also was a very accomplished athlete, and his main thing was running and long jumping, which was a terrific asset, the midfield playing that he did. So I'm sure that that was a great reason why he was such a good player, really, truly.
Do we know how he did in that, Breda, in his athletic career? Any outstanding memories for you?
Well, the main thing is they went on to win the Tarleton Games, like.
Talks about that.
You know, John Joshihi and several more of them, I'm sure the footballers went on to play in that.
Yeah. What do we know about his refereeing career? Just he speak about his career to you. You remarked to me one time, Breda, that he never wanted to talk about himself.
Well, to tell you the truth now, I am the second youngest of the family, but on the morning after Daddy died, I saw in the paper the achievements of my father. Never knew a blessed bit. The man never spoke about himself in any way. We never knew a blessed thing. That's the truth.
You're deeply involved in the Cairns O'Reilly's Football Club. Why wouldn't you be? Because mm-hmm. to be traitorous of you if you weren't.
Yeah.
But nowadays, Breda, is your dad spoken of a lot by people that you meet? Is your dad remembered as he should be?
Well, I'd say like a lot of the younger people wouldn't know, but Petty Lottimus and him kept my dad very much alive. He'd always acknowledge him at all the socials or any function, and he'd say that, why wouldn't I be in the club when my dad was there before me, and he found a member, and you know, so on. And my daughter Christine, of course, is in the club as well, doing a lot of work.
Look, it would be remiss of us, of course, if we didn't speak about your mother. Now, tell us about your mother. Who was she? Where did she come from? And what was her name? And how did she get on with Sean? Did she just laugh away when he was doing all this work? Was she a GA widow?
Well, no, really not. She was a Blenheim lady as well, Mary Bridget Foley. And she was very involved in the GA with Daddy, and very verbal, I'm afraid, like ourselves. She would be heard before she would be seen. And many a ref had to turn to her to behave yourself, Mary Bridget. You know, Daddy then was such a quiet man with the pipe in his mouth, and there would be never a word. And Mother would be there roaring, and there was nothing. We always said she should only pay a half price going into match, because she only saw one team. And that was Kerry all her life.
Did she help your dad with his secretarial work?
No, really. Mammy was always very busy in the house, in the kitchen, with big family and everything. But Daddy working in the home was wonderful, because he did help her when he could.
Yeah. Breda, as we're talking about your dad here this evening now, looking back at it, his was a remarkable life. His was a remarkable achievement. And what he achieved in GA circles and outside of everything, it was absolutely unbelievable. Even looking back, and now, even you being his daughter, would you say the same thing?
I would.
Did he take a drink?
Oh, yes, now and again he would.
Breda, great memories. And before I finish with you, I want to thank you for setting up all this interview with the whole family, because we started talking about this over 12 months ago, and I want to thank you sincerely. Now I'm talking to the one of Sean's daughters, Lonnie. Lonnie, what do we know about his Republican background?
Well, he didn't talk a lot about it himself, but only Mammy telling us things about it. But we knew he was in the IRA, and Mam was in the Cumann na Mban, and they were very involved in the Blenheville area and Strand Street area. And I know Dad led a troop out in the Blenheville area, and they had safe houses they could go to, and they lived a lot up in the mountains, in Slievemish Mountains. They actually took a railway carriage up into the mountains, and they used to sleep there when they were on the run. And he also was involved in drilling the men, because he had a bit of army training, because his father was a military man, and he went to college in England, military college in England, for a while. No, my dad. My dad did. No, his father was a military man in the regular army in Ireland. Right. And he then went on to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police for some years before he retired. So Dad was entitled to go to a military school in England, and he went there for some time. And we think that when the First World War broke out, when he came home, he was only 18, and his family didn't allow him to go back. So he used to train the IRA recruits. So he did that. Then he was involved, of course, very much.
Did he spend time in prison?
He did. He was in Cork Prison, and then he was shifted up to the north to Ballykinlar Prison, up in the north.
And of course, like all men of that time, they were reluctant enough to talk about it.
Yes, he wouldn't talk about it himself, but Mam would tell you the odd story, and then he would tell you the odd story. Like he told me about one time when they were surrounded up in, they were in a house, what they call a safe house again, up in the mountains around Corraheen, and they were surrounded by the Black and Tans, and Billy Miles was the scout, and he was the leader of the troop, and they had to get out of the house because they were surrounded. They had to make a run for it, and he was leading the men out, and Billy Miles said, "No, Jack, I'm the scout, I go out first." And he was shot dead the minute he went outside the door. So my dad always said, really, he should have been the one to die at that time, you know.
Lot of missing on them all.
He thought so much of all these brave men, you know.
Yes, yeah. Lonnie, your memories of your dad?
Well, my dad was a wonderful man, and my mother a wonderful woman. We had beautiful home life because we were so privileged that my dad and my mum were always at home. Mm. My dad having his office in the house. Yeah. And he always included the family in everything, and he'd go down. He loved to watch the young teams playing down the green after school. In the evenings, they had a pitch at the side of the school, and in the evenings they'd be playing there. They'd have team games at night, maybe training, and we'd go for a walk around the park with Mam and Dad, and he'd always take us in to watch the young guys, the youngsters playing. He loved to see the youngsters coming up and see the talent coming up.
Lonnie, was the whole family consumed by GAA growing up? Was GAA the dominant force in the McCarthy household?
Very much so, very much so. And around Munster final time and Munster game times, we were very, very, it was a very tense situation in our house. But Daddy always, Mammy loved the GAA every bit as much as my dad, and she loved to go to the games. So if the Munster final was on in Killarney, you know, she had 10 children, so it wasn't easy for her to go to games. But Dad would provide a taxi. We had Ned Carey in Day Place and Henry Carrick, who were taxi drivers. And Dan Ryan used to...
I remember Dan Rattamerson, the great referee and player.
Yeah, exactly. And Mr. McKellistrom as well. They had a pub up in Castle Street. He used to drive him.
Yeah.
And Dennis Moriarty in latter years. Oh, yeah. Dennis was wonderful as well. And Ned Carey was a very gentle man and a lovely man, and he was very good with children. So if the Munster final was on in Killarney, we'd always get to go with Mum. And he'd send Ned back. Ned would drive Dad out early in the morning because he'd have to be there very early to arrange everything. And then he'd send Ned back for us. And about 12:30, Ned would arrive back, and Mum and all the children would pile in, and off we'd go. And we'd go in by the mental hospital, St Finian's, yeah, in that gate, yeah, and there'd be somebody waiting to bring us down into the stand to our seats, and it was a lovely memory. But he always thought of his family.
When all the Munster and the county board work was going on, where did the Cairns O'Rahillys come into it? Because he was one of the founder members of the Cairns O'Rahillys. But did he talk a lot about this? He go to the matches, and would he keep in touch with the club?
Oh, very much so. Yes, he would. We'd go to all the O'Rahillys games. We'd all march up to all the O'Rahillys games, no matter where they'd be on. And the whole family would be taken. And my mum was absolutely unreal follower, and she was very vocal, where Dad was very quiet. But John Cassands used to come down an awful lot to our house, of course, and Paddy Paul Fitzgerald to talk to him, because he was a wonderful man to give people advice. He had a photographic memory, and he knew the rules from rule book back to front. He could quote any rule for you.
Your mother was a very vocal person.
She was indeed.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that her daughter, Breda, is just as vocal at the matches.
She is very like her. Yeah, yes, indeed. Good. She may look like my dad, but she's like my mum in spirit. She's very vocal to cheer on her team.
Did you, growing up and in later life, did you appreciate what your father had achieved and all what he had done in relation to playing and training and being secretary and referee and all things like that? And is it appreciated now? Do you think?
Yeah, we thought my father was a wonderful man always, yeah, and we thought he was a most amazing man. He did so many things. He was an administrator, a player, a referee, and an advisor to anybody who wanted advice. And we always thought he was an amazing man. But he never wanted praise for what he did. So he was a quiet man and always in the background. And so really people never knew what he did. He's an unsung hero, really, you know.
He's one of the men that build the tradition of Kerry and build the tradition of the GA. But I would be sincerely hoping that this programme will enlighten people more about what he did. Your final memory about your dad? Or have you anything else to add?
Well, no, only that he was the most wonderful man I ever knew anyway.
Well said, Lanny. Lovely stuff. Well done. Well done. Jerry, you're holding in your hand there your grandfather's diary. And here's some remarkable gems written into that.
Yeah, I was very lucky in, after the office had been cleared, I went up to see what might have been left, and I came across this diary, which is from 1928, and it was the year that he got married, but it was also the year where he was considering his future, and at the end of January there's a little synopsis of what was happening in that month, what was going through his head, and it gives you an idea of how the man thought and what he was thinking about. And there's 1928, and there's a bit of fun in it as well. And this is just the synopsis from the end of January 1928. And the thing I love about this is it's in his handwriting, and it's a direct link from him to us, and it's from way beyond the grave. He's talking to us about how different our lives could have been if he followed a different path than he did at this particular time. This month has been full of exciting and disappointing events. Firstly, the good news, as I thought, that my coupon for £500 was correct. Secondly, brother's invitation to come out if you cannot get anything to do at home. All his brothers were gone to America. Thirdly, decisions, remarriage and immigration. Fourthly, seeking secretaryships, which I think will give me a busy time and which I would not touch if I thought I would not be worth the commission. I think that tells you an awful lot about the man, that he knew there was a challenge there that he could do, and it was something that was worth doing, and he was willing to give it his time. Then there was the disappointment in connection with the £500, of course, which was not altogether unexpected. 1,556 competitors received 6 and 5 each. I have not cashed that cheque yet, and hardly think of it. So that just gives you an idea of the man, and that comes directly from him. And then in the back of the diary, he has a whole pile of little sayings and snippets of wisdom, and some of them are very good. I'll just give you a couple of them. Nothing breeds suspicion like mystery. A fool talks when he should act, and acts when he should talk. And then here's another one that links to that. The man who only knows how to keep his mouth shut knows only half the game. Like there's fierce wisdom in that. And he says a bad loser always lacks one of two things: breeding or backbone. And the one that I like, and the one I think kind of sums up an awful lot of what he did, is the proof of a thing is in its results. And the proof of his greatness is in the results that he achieved in his lifetime.
Yeah, give us a few more there.
Pledges are like perfume, some are poisonous. Test him before you trust him. We are none of us wise, but some are less foolish than others. So I think there's some lovely stuff in there. Oh yeah, and one, the very last one that he has, I think we should all pay heed to it, because some of us don't know when to shut up. Every public man who could do so should utter one great oration. The man who tried to deliver two was indiscreet. The man who made a third was a fool.
Lovely stuff. Lovely stuff. Now you have something. Have you something else there? Some did he? Have you a poem?
Oh, I have. Yeah.
Tell us about that, shall we?
Okay. My grandfather loved recitations, but as well as that, he was a poet himself, and he wrote some wonderful ballads. Now most of them have been lost in the mists of time, but in that same diary, I came across one that he wrote for a friend of his, Michael O'Flynn, who was killed during the Troubles. And this is a very poignant piece, but it's especially relevant to, there it is, yeah, to his time. Like when he came to be the trainer of the Kerry team, it was very much a poison chalice. There was a huge challenge there. You had, at the time, you had two different Kerry teams. You had a Republican Kerry team and a Free State Kerry team. And they weren't talking to each other. They weren't going to play together. And the whole thing was completely disjointed. And they needed to do something with them. They needed to put them together. And you asked me a question there last week about how did he come to be picked for that role. And I don't think he was picked for that role. I think nobody would touch it. And nobody would go anywhere near it. And I think that he stood up and said, we have to try this at least. And we have to go and do it. And he was that kind of man who would say, there's something that needs to be done. If nobody else is going to do it, I'm going to go in and make sure it gets done. And he did it. And not only did he make sure he got it done, he got it done very, very well. So, but to give you an idea of what it must have meant to him, this poem he wrote about a friend of his who was killed, and it was during, it goes back to the time of the Civil War, which was a very, very difficult time for all of those people, because they'd fought together in the War of Independence, and they would have fought and died for each other. And then a short time later, they were fighting against each other. And that must have been very, very difficult. And then when that finished, to have to try and put things back together again. And this poem just gives you an idea of some of what he might have been feeling. Okay, so I hope I can do it justice. I was thinking today of a comrade gay, a comrade fond and true, and my heart is sad and the tidings bad in the message I got of you. With your spirit bold and your heart of gold, that heart you to Ireland gave, O God above, the boy I loved should be lying in a martyr's grave. O Mickey Flynn down in the glen, they will pray for your soul tonight. The boys all there and the Colleen's fair will miss your spirit's light. And high in the gale your mother's wail will be calling on God to save her boy so pure on the lonely moor who lies in a martyr's grave. Oh, had you died on the mountainside with a rifle in your hand, as your sires of old who died before in defence of old Ireland. Sure my heart would dance if you got the chance along with your comrades brave, but a traitor's blow laid your spirits low to fill a martyr's grave. Full well they knew that cowardly crew, unarmed you stood at bay. They shook with fear as force grew near to gather around their prey. Full well they knew that Free State crew no mercy you could crave, but the painter hissed as the cross you kissed where you filled the martyr's grave. But Erin soon, like a bud in June, her freedom will proclaim, and Mickey Flynn, your name will then be garlanded with fame. Then that Irish sot who fired that shot, his infamy will not save, for the brand of Cain will cling to the name that sent you to a martyr's grave.
Jory, this is a part of him that we haven't heard about. Did he write a lot of stuff?
Oh, he did, yeah. I came across some things in his office when I was younger, and I wish I had more sense and had held on to them. And he wrote some wonderful ballads about football games, about young fellas developing in the GAA. He wrote lots of poems about the Troubles and different things like that. But he also used to do the Skellig's Lists every year. Coming up to Lent, the Skellig's List would be published. The Skellig's was the only place you could get married during Lent, even though I don't think anybody went out there to get married. But the Skellig's List were a great bit of fun. And what they would do is they would write poems about people. Now, it was supposed to be anonymous, but I think everybody knew he was the one who was doing it. And in the diary, he mentions preparing the lists, going over the lists, and then publishing the lists. And that was a big bit of fun that he used to do that time every year.
Are all these things last, are you telling me?
Not all of them. Like, we have this one, we have another one. a couple of his poems have been saved. Yeah, but his ability to do this has been passed on. I would say in each of the families there are people who are very good singers and songwriters. There are people who can write poetry or prose very well. The ability to put something on paper or to capture something in a way hasn't been lost with him. It's been passed on and will continue to be passed on. But I would love to have more of his things. We have a tape of him doing a recitation, which you may be able to include in this. And it's a wonderful piece, and I'd love to hear the end of it. It's one of these ones, like Sis says, where he goes so far and gets stumped. But there's a lot of emotion in the recitation he does. It's not one you'll probably have heard before. And it's a bit of an attack on the church, and it's a bit of it gives you a reflection of what they must have gone through with the church and their feelings towards the church after what had happened with them being excommunicated and things like that. So it'll be interesting to hear it and just to see how it goes.
Finally, Jerry, and of course, naturally enough, we could stay talking all night about him. In today's world and in the GA today, it would be my opinion that he would rank equal to anybody that ever stood in a field or ever was a delegate to a county board or was ever was an officer in the GA, that he would equal anybody since the foundation of the organisation. Is that a very broad statement?
I'll just paraphrase my grandfather's diary again. The proof of a thing, Guiji, is in its results, and I think his results speak for themselves.
Now I'm talking to Sean's daughter, Mary. Mary, you have great memories of your dad travelling to meetings and the drivers and things like that. And of course, he did an awful lot of travelling. What memories have you of that?
Well, you know, Daddy would, like, once we'd go to our destination, Daddy would be off, of course, to his meeting. And I'd do a little bit of shopping his driver would be with me, come around, and then Dad would come back when the meeting was over and see that everybody was fed, and you know, and that everything was well, like before we'd go back home, and then we'd have our sing songs coming home, yeah. And then we'd have a little, what you call it again, we'd stop over and have a meal, and Daddy would, we all had sing songs there. And Dad would always do a recitation.
What was his favourite recitation?
No, I can't remember that.
Yeah.
But he was doing his recitation, and all of a sudden, he stopped. Stumped, lads, stumped. He couldn't think the bloody thing. He couldn't think anymore.
You spoke about his driver. Of course, he never had a car himself, did he?
Never.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah.
And
how does he travel? Did they hire a taxi, or did the GA provide a car or something for him?
No.
Yeah.
No, I did it because
he had a taxi driver always.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
He had several taxi
drivers.
What's
the story about walking in step around Ballyard?
Yes, because I loved Daddy so much, and Daddy would go always take up his post, and then I would go walking with him.
Yeah.
And I would always, like, you know, try and keep up with Daddy.
Yeah.
Keep in step,
yeah.
You see. And if I was out of step, then I'd have to stop a minute, Dad. And then we'd start again. And then we were we were sound then, going off again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just adored my father. And that used to, you know, that was my own special thing,
yeah.
That I was with my dad. Because, you see, all of them, I had to have him to myself for a little bit.
You had him to yourself one day in Croke Park when the Shanty O'Kelly came into the picture. What was that story?
Did I?
With Uncle Mick?
Oh, Uncle Mick. Oh, God, yes. Well, I know that the boys were playing as well, the handball, and Daddy had to go in there, like, and give them the results. My brother
was a handballer.
Yeah,
Pat.
And now, we had been in London to meet Mike, because he hadn't met him, Uncle Mick, like, you know. And so we went over there, and we had some fun, didn't we, Mike? Yeah. And he hadn't seen...
He meeting Shanty.
Okay, yes.
Go
yes. Well, it was a great surprise from Daddy to Uncle Mick.
Yeah.
And he had... Shanty, okay. Hid at the back
of the stand.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Daddy took him in when the match was over, and he went in,
And honestly, it was the most beautiful moment.
Did they throw their arms around Uncle Mick and Shanky, throw their arms around each other?
It was beautiful. Was it? Yeah. It was beautiful. They were great friends. Lovely they were story. Great friends.
And explained that they had been imprisoned together in the time of the Troubles.
Time of the Troubles, yes.
Uncle Mick and Shanty had been in prison together.
It was beautiful.
Yeah. Now, sis, what's your favourite memory of your dad?
My favourite memory, there was thousands.
Have you a memory of any specific person calling to the house? Or
oh, God, yes.
Yeah, who?
And I hunted a lot of them, too.
Yeah. Who?
Because he couldn't, you know, he couldn't have them all.
Yeah.
But the ones I didn't like, God.
You hunted them?
I would.
You hunted
them? Yeah.
Listen to me, well done. Now I'm talking to Tina, another one of Jack's, Sean's daughters. Tina, I would imagine Christmas in the McCarthy house was a special time.
It was a very special time. We used to have great times and plenty of presents, and we used to light a candle every night, and each one of us would light it. One of us would light it every night, you know.
Yes.
So,
great old tradition.
Great old tradition, yes.
Your memories of your dad, you remarked to me there how he'd be up before you in the morning. Was he an early riser, by the way?
He'd get up before me. And he'd have my breakfast ready for me before I'd go to work.
What time would he go to bed and what time would he get up?
Oh, he'd go to bed around 12 o'clock, I'd say.
Yeah.
And he'd get up, well, for me now, he used to get up 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And just different times I started work then later at 9 o'clock, but he'd always be up to have my breakfast ready for me in the morning.
What about visitors to the house? Like, I'd imagine there'd be an awful lot of...
Ty Crowley used to be... He's come very, very often. He was a great friend of my dad's. Yeah. And you had Paddy Brown Brosnan, and you had...
legendary names.
Yes.
Jake Skeern,
that's right, yeah.
Small little man, and great, always in great form.
Yes.
Yeah, he was indeed, yeah.
You still travel to matches with him, Tina?
No, only just Killarney, or I went to Limerick a few times with him. I remember going to Limerick one time, and I'll never forget it. There was, I don't know, two or three people died in the pitch that day. It was a very, very warm day.
Yeah.
But I couldn't tell you what date it was or anything, but or even what match it was.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget it. There were people brought across the pitch. There was but three people died or something.
Of course, he was out practically every Sunday when he was secretary of the Munster Council. He was out every Sunday. Would he go early? Have you any memories of him going off in the morning, coming home at night?
He would. Or he'd go... maybe 8 o'clock in the morning, and he'd be late, it'd be 6, 7 o'clock in the evening before he'd come home.
Yes.
And of course your mother didn't be delighted to see him home, she'd have the dinner ready for him.
She would. Indeed. Always.
Yeah.
So what's your one favourite memory about your dad?
Oh, I loved him to bits.
Isn't that memory the best memory you could remember? It? Well done, Tina, well done. Now I'm speaking to Jerry Enright. He was a grandson of Sean's. Kitty McCarthy is his mother. Jerry, your memories of your grandfather?
I'm just sitting here now looking at a photograph of my grandmother and grandfather at the beach in Derrymore. And I remember from a very young age, my grandfather had a great selection of headwear. He had lovely trilby hats. He had flat caps. And he also had a concoction he made up himself with a handkerchief with four knots in the corner of it for days at the beach. But he was a very well turned up man most of the time until he went to the beach. And that tradition has carried on to today with some of the outfits that his children wear when they go to the beach. My biggest memory of him really is standing at the top of the steps in Day Place. And we would be playing... on the street in Day Place, we could be playing football, we could be playing Jason, we could be doing up plays, we could be having a concert, we could be doing anything at all. But Granda would be standing at the top step, at the door, his two hands behind his back, looking out over us, and we were completely and absolutely secure in our world because we knew that he was there to take care of us. He had a quietness and a strength about him that you knew that you were very safe when you were in his company no matter what was going to happen. He had a saying, and we never quite knew what it actually meant, but every day he'd come out, he'd open the door, and he'd stand at the top step, and he'd say, the boys were there around the square.
That's
right. Yeah. Now, there's a song, or there's a poem, or there's something in there with that in it, and it'll come someday, but It's only in the formative stages yet.
Are you now, growing up and you're a young man, you'll be the youngest person we've interviewed in relation to Sean. Are you astounded at his achievements and all he achieved and all that he was involved in his career?
Well, I think we all look to our parents and look to our grandparents and we think that they're the greatest people that ever walked the earth. And we're all told stories from very early times and we all believe from very early times that these people are greater people than anybody else. And we would have had our heads full of stories of being descended from royalty and of being all kinds of wonderful things. But we always knew my grandfather was a great man. But we knew him as being a great grandfather. In the past couple of years, since we started to look at his career, since we started to look and research what it was he did, he's actually turned out to be bigger and better than anything that we ever thought that he was. And one of the things that adds to his greatness, I think, is his humility, in that he did all these wonderful things. He did all these fantastic things, and when they were done, that was enough for him. There was no need to talk about it. There was no need to blow about it. We've done these things, let's move on and do the next thing. And he would move on and do the next thing. And everything he did, like, people talk about his achievement with the four in a row and with things like that, but it wasn't him alone that did that. Now, he was a force, a driving force in making it happen. But you had people like Dinjo Bailey. You had a team of players. Now, they were individual players when he got them and he moulded them into a team. But there was a lot of people there who contributed to the finished product. And he was always very aware of the other people involved in everything he was doing. And another memory I have of him, a very strong memory I have of him, when he was dying, no matter where you were in Tralee or no matter what was going on, at 7 o'clock in the evening, you would turn up at their place. Because your ordinary man would have been bedridden at this stage, but my grandfather insisted on getting up to come downstairs and spend some time with his family and watch television or have a chat or whatever would be happening. But to get him down the stairs, we'd got this chair. And Granda would have to be carried down the stairs on the chair. So we'd all go up into the bedroom, put him into the chair. There'd be two flights of stairs. He'd have to be manhandled down. There could be 30 people there doing this now. But Granda would be sitting up in the chair. And if you were at the back and you couldn't get your hand on the chair, he'd stop the whole thing. And he'd make someone move out of the way to make a bit of room. And he'd get everyone in. So you'd have 30 people coming down the stairs, tripping over each other. But everybody would have a hand on the chair. And everybody would be part of the team. And everyone would get him down the stairs. And at the end of the day, he knew that they all did a little bit. And they all felt good for helping.
And right to the end, he was bringing everybody together, he was using the whole thing as a team effort.
Yeah,
he was. Now, you've been looking into his career, you've been examining it a lot from his early days. What has amazed you mostly about his achievement?
I think the fact that, what he did, each of the things he did were remarkable things. To have done them would be one thing, but to have done them and kept them quiet. And not only did he keep them quiet, but you've heard of all the people who called to the house and all the people that he played with and all the people who knew his achievements all called to the house, and they never let on that he did any of the things he did either. And I must say that when I was starting to do this, I was thinking that he couldn't have done all these things and all these people kept it quiet. It'd have to have been said. But it's all there on the record. We've got it from the newspapers, we've got it from photographs, we've got it from articles that have been written in books and things like that. And the thing that amazes me is that he did it, but he kept it quiet afterwards, and it wasn't a big deal to him. Now, I think it's a very big deal that needs to be recognised, and it needs to be, like, you asked questions earlier on about what would you think would be a good memorial to him. I think his record is a very good memorial to him. I think the results he achieved and what he did in his lifetime are fantastic, and he doesn't require any more than that. He doesn't need a physical memorial, and it's great that he's to be remembered, and it's great that we remember him, and it's great that we can share those memories with people now, because his story is a wonderful story, and he was a fantastic man, and it's a story that deserves to be told. Like, when we were starting to do this a couple of years ago, I felt that maybe we were doing something that he might not have wanted to do. But when I look back at his life and what he did for other people during his life, his friends, Mickey Flynn, who was killed during the Troubles, his friend Dick Fitzgerald, who he had the stadium in Killarney named after, he put memorials in place for all of his friends and all of the people that he lived and he met through his life. And that in itself is testament to him. He never put his own name forward. He always put forward the names of other people. So he recognised the need for recognition and the need for memorial. But he knew when he was like passing on that he was leaving all these people behind him who would remember him and who would remember him for what he thought was his greatest gift, which was his gift as a father. And he had the foresight, I think, early in his career, when when most of his children were on their way, to set up his office in his home, because he knew he had a lot of work to do. It was going to take an awful amount of time, and if his job had been based in Turles, which could very easily have been, he would have had to leave every Sunday night probably and not get home until Saturday morning, and he would never see his family. But by putting the thing in his own home, he was able to work and keep his family life going. And the amazing thing is, and they'll all have said it, and the same thing would apply to me and to all my cousins who grew up in the house, and we all lived with him for at different times. The line between work and play was very, very blurred. No matter who was in the office with him. Like, I remember as a small kid meeting people like Sean O'Shiachán, and he would be down to meet my grandfather, and they would have very important business to attend to. Yet, I would be included in the meeting. Now, I wouldn't have any idea what was going on or what they were talking about, and I wouldn't have had the Irish to understand a lot of the conversations they were having. But we were allowed to be in it. We were allowed to be part of it, and it became part of our lives, and it became a very normal part of our lives. But it allowed him to work very hard as well. Like, he was working 7 days a week, yeah. Not 5 days a week.
Now, you mentioned Irish.
Yes.
Now, he wasn't born a fluent Irish speaker, but he went away. This was another great tribute to him.
Yes.
He became a fluent Irish speaker.
Yes, he had a great love for all things Irish. Like, he was an Irish nationalist from the very beginning. He believed very much in Irish culture and Irish games, and the Irish language was the cornerstone of the whole thing. And for him to do his job, it was a requirement of his job, but even if it wasn't, it was very important to him and to most of the people that he did business with. They did their business which wasn't their native tongue, they had to relearn it. They did their business in Irish because they felt that was very, very important. And it was no good just having the idea, we'll go up and we'll kick a football and we'll play a Gaelic game. If we're going to be Gaels, if we're going to be true Gaels, we must speak the language, play the games and embrace the culture. And he did all those things.
Now, Johnny Wall is married to one of Sean's daughters, Tina. Johnny, you would be very familiar with all the ins and outs of Gaelic football and sport and everything else in this county. But this Sean McCarthy was a remarkable man, one of the all-time great Kerry personalities.
He was a phenomenal. Honestly, I mean, I only knew the man when I got married, lucky enough to marry his daughter. But the people that called to the house and the people I got to know, I used to love watching the likes of Paddy Barnbrassen come in over because he was a hero of mine, you know, and see people like that. But Sean himself was a very gentleman, very kind man, you know. And what I used to like about him, he was a great man for quotations. And when he got mad, he'd never show it. But he'd say, like, if he was speaking about a fellow that made him mad, he'd say, the more he gazed, the more his wonder grew at the workings of the wheelbarrow. In other words, like, he was a bit of a fool. You know? But he was great for saying things like that, you know. He was a very kind man, very generous. He never spoke badly about anyone. And I remember Joe Cahan one time telling me like that he was known as the player's friend, because any time they were short the money or anything like that to go to a match, he always looked after them. They got it as a loan, knowing in their heart they never had to pay it back.
Johnny, his total involvement overall as a player and a referee and as an administrator and as a trainer and everything else, it was absolutely stupendous. I would say there must be very, very few people in the GA that had such a record of his. And of course, he kept it all then by training the four in a row, 29, 30, 31, 32.
Oh, he did. But, I mean, as I said, I only got to know him later in life, you know, as he came to the end of his career. But the amount of people, you know, that what he did was unbelievable. 29, 30, 31 and 32, after Kildare won the Sam Maguire, the first Sam Maguire, 1928, they won the Sam Maguire 4 in a row after that. I mean, that's phenomenal. And his name should be on that cup, actually, in my opinion, for what he did for Kerry. What he did for the GAA itself, he brought it to where it is today, because at the time, I think Kitty was saying it, you know, back in the 1920s, when they were all Fine Gael and Sinn Féin, IRA, the whole lot all mixed up together, he got them all together, he trained them all, he had that way about him that he could get people to work together. And I think, you know, that's something you have or you haven't got. You know, and he had that. He was able to bond people and make people give their utmost for what they believed in.
Johnny, there's an awful lot of talk in today's world about trainers and managers of teams of all different, with the county teams and all. But I mentioned earlier on there to one of the girls, we might nearly summarise now that he was appointed trainer of the Kerry team to actually unite the fractions. Would that be, could we put that down as nearly definite?
I said that's a definite, because I know at the time, John Joshi, I have an uncle, Jimmy Wall, who played at the time, who was in the Free State Army, and he was captain of the Mitchells team that won the first county championship for the Mitchells above, you know, and Jack McCarthy, and they're all together in loads of photographs down through here, all the different people who fought on different sides at a bad time in our history, and they all went together under the banner of the GAA, and Jack McCarthy was one of the men that did that, and without him, I don't think it would have happened.
But behind it all, then, he was a great trainer.
He was a great trainer, but he was before his time. If you take the like nowadays, they try and get they bring him out to Barcelona and they bring him to Spain to try and get people to bond. He brought him into Tralee and put him into a hotel for a week, and they were all eating and drinking together all the week and going home for the weekend. Sure, that was way before that time, I think, and going for a run in the evening. I mean, I remember he was saying, I was talking to him one time about the television. Like that 6 o'clock in the evening, it is great to be able to watch the news now, because you had nothing. Jeez, he said, in my time, he said, we'd go for a trot. He said, we'd go for a jog, maybe back from Blenheim, back as far as Ballyseedy, out to Phoenix, and maybe back in as far as the Spa, and back into Blenheim. That's about 15 or 16 miles.
And then, Johnny, his involvement in Cairns O'Rahill, he's founded the club, training the club, playing in an All-Ireland senior final, winning an All-Ireland junior football medal, and then refereeing an All-Ireland final. Then he was Munster secretary. He was involved in the Kerry County Board. All that, it was some packed life.
He did everything. In fairness, like, you know, if pity, he wasn't born in Borrowby, Jesus Christ, like we could have done with him up till. Like, you know. But he was a stranglehold man to the backbone, you know. He really, you know, I think you epitomise it when you say like that. He was everything to the GAA. He did everything, and he did everything right.
Johnny, now looking back to finalise it, I suppose really he'd have been a fitting president of the Gaelic Athletic Association. He had done everything.
He'd done everything, and he was the right type of man. He had gone through life in a hard way. He brought up a great family. They're a credit to the GAA. All his family are a great credit to the GAA.
How should he be remembered?
Well, I'd like to see a statue from below in the square in Tralee, and I'd love to see something done in his honour. Maybe, I know there's a cup at Strand Road for some game that I think the sisters gave some years ago, but I'd love to see something on a long going, something nice, a bust of him maybe in the museum in Dublin.
Oh, so I'm talking to another one of Sean's daughters. I'm talking to Kitty. Kitty, your memories of your dad?
Well, the thing that I remember quite a lot about is the week prior to the Munster final and Munster final weekend. And like one of my sisters said there, maybe it was Mike, about they thought we printed the tickets. So everybody and anybody was phoning and knocking at the door. And this day there was a knock on the front door, Munster final week, and towards the end of the week, I'd say, and I came up from our kitchen and out the hallway, and I was approaching the door when a head came around the top of the stairs. My father's office was in the second floor, and my daddy said to me, "I'm not in now, Kitty, I'm not in." So that was all right. Anyway, I opened the door and the gentleman was there, and he said, "Could I see your father?" And I said, "God, I'm sorry, he's not in." The next thing, the head comes around the door. "Oh, hello, dear, come in, I was just looking for you." And there I was with egg in my face. But anyway, to talk about my dad and the Munster final weekend, the poor man didn't draw his breath. He would get all his, make sure he had to do everything himself. There would never be a mistake when my dad was in charge, because no one was left to do their part all alone. He'd always check it out, make sure that everything was right. He'd come in and he'd go to the office, and he had all these canvas bags, satchels that they put over their shoulder, and the money would go into those. And he'd have his little bags with the change, and the change would have to go into the satchels so that the men would have change for the people when they came to get their tickets. The rolls of tickets, there was rolls of tickets for the world. And there was, he'd have his programs, and he'd have the cups would arrive during the week, the two cups, we'd have those for the week. And we knew those cups as well as one another. And he would go off early in the morning then. I'm probably forgetting a lot of the things now that happened in the office on the evening before, because it went out, he was there for a long time working. And he'd go off early in the morning. Peggy said all that now about going to the field and what would happen. Then the match would be over. He'd come to the match. During the match time, we never saw Daddy. Never saw him. He was out around watching the gates, watching the stiles, making sure that everything was okay. And there was an occasion when a gate was in the field into the sideline. And you had a special gate going in, but it was full. And it was announced that the sideline is now full, no one else can get in. And a Cork train had arrived, Cork and Kerry. And of course the Cork people wanted to get in as well as the Kerry people. And they went to rush the gate. You know, the gate just up and go at the Munster final. And they went to rush the gates, and my father stood in front of the gate. And John Barry, who was a reporter, pulled him out of the way, and the next thing, the crush came and the gate went. If he was there, they'd have walked over him. But then he'd go down into the whatever room they had, and all the guys would come in with their money, and that would all have to be counted. All that money would have to be counted. He'd have so many people that would count the money with him, and that would have to be taken then under police escort to the bank, and the bank manager would be waiting there to receive it. That would all, he would make sure of all that. Nobody would do that but himself. He would be the head man, overseeing everything, getting the money together, and it would be himself, probably Ty Crowley with him, who would take that money to the bank. And he'd deposit it there. But a story about that as well is that during, we had a bank strike in Ireland, I'd say the year before my father died, probably 1976. And you see, the big load of money now, what were they going to do with it? How would he protect it? How would it be safe until the banks opened? But what he did was, he, whatever place he would be, whether it would be Killarney or Cork, where he'd have the big matches with the big money, he would give it to the big businesses. And then they would give it back, right? So that strike went on for a good bit. And they were only still fixing it up when my father was dying. And at the week before he died, perhaps even the fortnight before he died, he was slipping in and out of comas. We didn't know it was comas, but it was, because he could sleep for a whole day, like maybe a whole day and a night. Then he would come back and he'd be okay. But on a Monday morning, there was a phone call, and I happened to be over from work, and I took the call. And it was Con Murphy of Cork wanting to know what happened to the money from the Munster final in Cork the previous year. And my father was inside in the bed, and he answered me from the bed that that money went to the biggest shop in Cork. Anyway, I can't remember the name of it now. What was the biggest shop in Cork, Cash's, when you were there? Cash's. Yeah. And that they had it, and that was perfectly right. As well as that, when my father was very, very sick and dying at home, he could cast his mind back to anything he wanted to and bring it up, no matter how many years it was before that. And when he was very sick and dying, we were all there, and he used to call us Jack's Angels. Mm-hmm. That's the name here.
Wonderful memories, wonderful memories. Michael, tell us what you had there.
Well, this is a copy of the oration made by Michael Frawley. He was the chairman of the Munster Council at the time my father died. And then the JA, of course, did everything as far as the funeral was concerned. They paid for the funeral. They insisted that they should do this for my father. And so I've got a copy in my hand here of that particular oration. If I could just read it out.
We'd love to hear it and record it.
Before we leave this gravesite, where today we have laid to rest the mortal remains of Sean McCarthy, it is my sad privilege to speak some words in tribute to everyone's friend. All of us so fortunate to have made his acquaintance, and in particular those of us so luckily enriched by his guidance and hospitality, will forever remember this fatherly figure. The heart that has been stilled was a heart that beat with love and care for his family, and indeed for all people. In offering our sincere sympathy to his wife and to the other members of his family on that great loss, it is true to say that their loss is a sad loss. A long and rewarding day has drawn to a close, and an illness borne patiently and courageously must have earned for him the greatest reward of all, eternal peace and light in God's home. To countless people, both in Kerry and far beyond, Sean McCarthy was synonymous with an astonishing range of human qualities. Time and inadequacy on my part do not afford me the scope to deal with these as I should. However, from the vantage point of my brief and treasured relationship with such a stalwart, I will endeavour to echo our appreciation and admiration for the man and his setting. He was a man of intense charm. He was a superb mixture of strength and tenderness, purposefulness and generosity, tempered with a downright mixture of devilment and fun. Being born in the area which has produced so many literary figures, he had that same wit and aptness of expression, so endemic of the people of those parts. He was generous to a fault, and it was his tremendous love for his fellow man and his innate Christianity which prompted him at all times to think only of the cares and needs of others, many times to the detriment of his own. He was a wonderful family man, and expressed this deep love and fatherly affection in a most attractive form. He was a true friend, because unto himself he was always true. And to paraphrase Shakespeare, he therefore could not be false to any man. Each chapter in his life is an evocative picture which combined to make the whole charming, enigmatic, bigger than life. Whole man that was Sean McCarthy. This free, open and spontaneous approach to life was one which gave him a wonderful zest for living, with which he imbued all in whom he came in contact. It is within the framework as Secretary of the Munster Council that we in the GEA saw him and evaluated his worth to the association. Firstly, he was endowed with a rare and excellent mind. He had a sharp analytical intellect and a memory of frightening accuracy, combined with understanding and wisdom. These wonderful attributes were invaluable. He spoke little and thought much. Many a foolhardy or ill-conceived suggestion would have got through the channels of authority but for his timely intervention. Prompted by his superb power to visualize the impending pitfalls which were not apparent to others, his aptness of expression and wit, to which I have already referred, were the amount for which he often diffused a difficult situation. He was a regular reference library, and like the village schoolmaster, one wondered how one small head could carry all he knew. While I know that Sean would have a word of dismissal for such sentiment, still, it is true that his colleagues held him in awesome respect. While enjoying the camaraderie which was possible with such an honest, genial, sincere, and charming personality. The tapestry of the kingdom would be no tapestry of the kingdom would be complete without the name of Sean McCarthy interwoven into its design. Sean began his JAA activities with his local club at Strand Street in Tralee. He graduated to the Kerry senior football team and went with them to the All-Ireland semi-final in 1919. In 1924, he led his native county to victory in the All-Ireland Junior Championship of that year. He then turned his talents to refereeing for a period and had the honour of taking charge of the All-Ireland Senior Final between Dublin and Galway in 1934, the year of the Golden Jubilee celebrations. But it was as an executive that he made his greatest imprint. He filled the role of Secretary of the Munster Council since 1931 with distinction. His tremendous abilities were utilised to this extreme in the interests of the council. This total impartiality, his cooperation with and assistance to all, was evidence of the greatness of spirit and heart of the man. As a result of his utter dedication to the cause he loved so clearly, he has left behind a well-equipped, stabilised vessel, and it is up to us who come after him to steer it safely and well. We had an excellent instructor, and his words of counsel and wisdom will sustain us and aid us when we are confronted with problems, which we hope will be few as a result of his foresight and direction. If ever we are tempted to waver from the ideals for which the Gaelic Athletic Association stands for, the image of that glorious character, Sean McCarthy, and what he would expect of us, will rise before us.